These things happen. Yeah.
If I ever said I'm never scared, just know I mean it. If I ever said I fuck your bitch, just know I mean it.
Welcome back, listeners. We're back from hiatus.
Welcome back.
And we're here because we had to bring a show that had been long in the waits. It is the show where we talk about Alex Gordon's return to the Kansas City Royals. And if you're wondering what our intro song is, that is G-Eazy's I Mean It, which its significance is such that it was Alex Gordon's walk-up song in 2015. And now he means it when he says he's coming back to Kansas City for at least another four seasons. I'm sitting here in the Prairie Village Studios for BuiltOnTheBorder.com with Brody Johnson. Brody, how's it going?
Oh, 2016's been great with this news and just life in general, man.
Yeah, I mean, 2015 was a pretty solid year, but now 2016 is starting to slowly on the uptick up to be even better than 2015. So big news today out of Kansas City. News broke right around 9:30, 10 o'clock, mm-hmm. that Alex Gordon, lifetime Royal, is going to return for another 4 years. 4 years, $72 million deal to return to the ball club. We got the best free agent outfielder and arguably one of the best left fielders in the game today, and he's back in Kansas City. We can get into a lot of different things about numbers and, you know, his statistics, his career with the Royals in terms of production and everything, starting here as a third baseman, switching to left field, and then in his first season at left fielder, winning Gold Gloves. I think you can talk about all these individual accomplishments. But I think the most important thing is the Royals are getting back their face. They're getting back the leader of the clubhouse. Mm-hmm. They're getting back the guy that all these players who have been homegrown through this ball club look to and say, that's the guy we want to emulate. That's the guy we want to play like. And he's really one of those lead by example guys.
Exactly. He really is going to be this generation's George Brett.
Yeah.
And I think number four is going to go up there when he's all said and done. But I'm really excited. It's looking forward to next year. The whole squad's back. Danny Duffy was retweeting, like, that's Gordo right there. That is truly the man that he is.
Yeah, and I think one of the most important things that he said is, like, this is home. Mm-hmm. You know, eventually we're going to get this deal done. This is where his family is. This is where he wanted to come back to. He is from Lincoln, Nebraska, but obviously proximity. This is where he wanted to come back and be. This is the organization he wanted to be a part of. And really, this run that we have just started with two consecutive American League pennants, a World Series in 2015. This success was started in many ways by Alex Gordon. So it shows that we're going to take that guy who meant so much to our success and continue him along this run that hopefully will continue over the next three or four seasons as these younger guys who have already been huge, huge parts of this franchise as they continue to grow and get even better.
And the fact that his contract was, I believe, the largest in Royals history.
Largest in Royals history.
But it favored the club, too.
Yeah.
So it definitely shows that Dayton Moore is not afraid to go out and keep our team, the core of this team.
Right. And I think, you know, I bet there were probably a lot of negotiations where Dayton Moore had to hold pat and say, this is where we'll meet you. This is where we were willing to go to. But Dayton Moore is a smart general manager. I don't I don't see this deal being anything more than he was willing to give up. And one of the great things about the details of the deal is that it's backloaded. So next season and 2016 and 2017, we won't be paying a large amount of that contract. And I've also heard rumors. I don't know what the exact numbers are for after the 4 years are up, but it's even backloaded after his 4 years are finished. Really? So we can kind of cut some of those costs later down the road. Because realistically, at Alex Gordon's age, 31. Soon to be 32 in February, it's possible that this is one of the last major league contracts, if not the last major league contract he's going to sign. And I know there's a possibility he signs a 1 or 2 year deal at the end of his career to stay a lifetime Royal, but it's, you know, this could be it. He might go sail off into the sunset at the end of this 4 years. So I was just really excited to see a hometown guy. Now, some of the things that I heard today, you know, there are going to be those Royals fans that are, pessimists about this whole deal. Some view it as somewhat of a Billy Butler situation. Billy Butler was another one of those homegrown guys that we allowed to walk last year because we weren't going to meet him in the middle. We weren't going to, you know, financially stretch ourselves thinner than we wanted to go. And then we got Kendrys Morales. People are saying, well, there's going to be a replacement out there who could be better in production. I don't think that's the case.
No.
I mean, the outfield, who do you have left? You have Gerardo Parra. You have Denard Span, and really in terms of guys that would fit in that left field position, that's it. And with the flexibility of this contract, we now have the money to go out and seek another player to maybe rotate out of right field with Jared Dyson, Paul Orlando, whoever's going to play that spot next season, and go out and sign up a pitcher to replace Johnny Cueto, who we lost in free agency to the San Francisco Giants. So this deal not only is friendly looking forward, but is friendly for this offseason right now. You know, you lose Ben Zobrist, you lose Johnny Cueto, obviously huge parts of the equation. But Alex Gordon probably is thinking in his head, look, the more money I take, the less likely this team's able to be successful down the line. Mm-hmm. So it's very selfless on his part. Obviously, you know, it's hard to say that a guy who's taking in 4 years, $72 million is being selfless, but he really probably could have gotten almost twice that in the open market as a free agent. And it's just really impressive. It says a lot about his character, says a lot about his leadership, and it says a lot about his commitment to this organization to see a deal like this get done. And it makes me even more excited to go out there on opening day in 2016, watch them raise the banner and welcome Alex Gordon back yet again as Kansas City Royal for, I believe, his 10th season with the Royals.
It's amazing to think that it's already been 10 years with this club for all the ups and downs that really he has been the pinnacle of what this team has become since, what, 06?
Since 06. I mean, the carrying us from mediocrity to greatness has really just been his MO. I mean, this has really been what you characterize Alex Gordon about. I mean, every year that he's been here. Now, there were some tough years where he struggled at third base and struggled at the plate. That switch over to left field, though, ever since that switch to left field, it has been an upward climb. The Royals have continued to get better and better and better. And you can tell he's Ned Yost's guy in terms of guys that he points to in the clubhouse and says, be like this guy. You know, this guy shows up, he works hard, he takes care of his body, takes care of his family, and most importantly, you know, he's a great baseball player. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, that's the most important thing. Yes. And when you're making these kind of signings, but it's he's the whole package. And I think that these next 4 years are going to be the finish to a perfect marriage between Royals and Alex Gordon.
Exactly.
And I think there's not a whole lot more we can talk about. I mean, we can talk to her blue in the face about how much he's meant to us as a player. But again, he's like our generation's George Brett. Obviously not the same level of production. He's probably not going to be a Hall of Famer, but he will be in the Royals Hall of Fame. That's for sure. He already cemented that last season. Mm-hmm. And you know what? He came up with one of the biggest hits in Royals history in game one of the World Series in the ninth inning to put us even with the Mets.
To carry the just playoff mantra of you have to get it. It's not over till the fat lady sings.
Right. And you know, again, another part of this franchise, timely hitting. That's been, you know, timely hitting and the Royals have been synonymous for the last two seasons. And, you know, it really came to a head last year in game one. And if that he doesn't hit that home run and we go down 1-0 at home,
Whole new series.
And I don't know if we're hoisting the banner. I mean, one game can swing the entire series. So, again, just another reason why he's been so important. And we can't thank Alex Gordon enough. And we're just so excited to have him back. Because it was looking scary there for a little bit.
Yeah, it was.
You know, I tweeted out, all I want for Christmas is Alex Gordon a few weeks ago. And I think it was true. And it's the best late Christmas / birthday present I could have ever asked for. So shifting on from the Royals, because again, we could talk about that until we're blue in the face. I was in Allen Fieldhouse Monday night, big Monday, Kansas versus OU, one versus technically one, because one was number one in the AP poll and the other one was number one in the coaches poll. But for all intents and purposes, one versus two, Kansas versus Oklahoma, Big 12 heavyweights facing off 8:00. You got Dick Vitale and Brett Musburger calling the game. I'm in the house. It was absolutely incredible, Brody. I mean, I don't know if on television they did the noise level justice, but it was absolutely deafening.
That's one thing I did want to ask you was, I believe it was Vitale said, this is the loudest in the 35 years he's been able to commentate at Allen Fieldhouse. The loudest it's ever been.
Yeah.
And as a lifelong KU fan, did the noise compare?
It was the loudest. I mean, they're usually in the game, it's loud enough, but you can still hear what the person directly next to you is trying to yell into your ear. And I was screaming at my dad to try and have a conversation about what was going on the floor. Like, oh my God, Buddy Hield, he's out of his freaking mind.
Yeah.
And we couldn't even hear each other. So there came to be a point where we just stopped trying to communicate. And it was mostly just high fives and fist bumps the rest of the way. But it was absolutely incredible. I mean, not only did you see one of the greatest, you know, regular season conference games in college basketball history, you also saw one of the greatest individual performances by Buddy Hield, the shooting guard out of Oklahoma, who decided to stay another season after being projected to go potentially in the lottery of last year's NBA draft to stay around for the year and try and win an NBA – or not an NBA title, excuse me – an NCAA title with his Oklahoma squad. And he played incredible. I mean, you know, Big 12 Player of the Year last year, and he's looking even better this year. And the shots that Buddy Hield was getting were not easy shots by any means. I mean, he was – Frank Mason, all 5'10" of him was in Buddy Hield's grill the entire game, and he was having to step back, rise over, which, again, over Frank Mason, not that hard. But he was having to step back, fade away, rise over, double team, fight through traffic. And he was hitting them. He it seemed like every time KU seemed like they were going to go on a run, you know, get up 4, maybe 6, Hield stepped up and hit a big, huge shot to keep his team in it. And he had almost half of his team's points when it all came down to it. I mean, the final score, 108-106, and Buddy Hield had 46 of those 106 points for the Sooners. I mean, that's just absolutely incredible.
Yeah, he was, I mean, I think it was the third overtime and – you guys were up by 5, and they needed a 3. Obviously, put it on his shoulders, and a contested 3 just
drains
beautiful,
it. Right?
Beautiful
and,
shot.
Well, and the interesting thing about that play was the ball. The Oklahoma initially took a layup. Ball got tipped around, knocked out. You know, there's a scrum. It kicks out to Hield. He's got two Kansas defenders basically charging at him right in his face, and he drains it. I mean, I've never seen so much ice in someone's veins. I mean, it was like watching, you know, like Kobe Bryant out there take up, you know, take to the hardwood against against the Jayhawks. I mean, obviously retro Kobe Bryant.
After 50 minutes of basketball.
And to keep, to play that at that high of a level continuously for 55 minutes of basketball. And he was in essentially the entire game. It was absolutely incredible. And the other impressive thing in terms of minutes was that Bill Self played the same 5 players all through the 3 overtimes. And they managed to do the same thing for Oklahoma until Woodard fouled out. I mean, it was an absolute battle. Lon Kruger and Bill Self coached 2 absolutely outstanding teams. And if you had had another 30 seconds on the clock, I bet you Oklahoma might have had a chance to win. It was that back and forth the entire time. And, you know, you got to give credit to a lot of those KU players that seem like they've been around for a long time. Perry Ellis had one of his best games as a Jayhawk. Quietly, though. I mean, there were a lot of times where he disappeared for stretches. Then he'd come and hit 3 or 4 shots in a row. There were times where Wayne Selden just took over and seemed like he was putting the team on his back. Sophomore Devontae Graham played outstanding. Jamari Traylor, when he was in the game, a lot of high energy, high intensity plays. He had 3 highlight reel blocks. I think at least 2 of them made him on the top 10. And it was just incredible. And then, of course, the guts of Frank Mason to have to guard Buddy Hield. Obviously, he gave up 46 points to Buddy Hield. But there were some plays he made where he kept Hield, you know, almost 30 feet away from the basket. He was so up in his grill. So it was just a really impressive win. And I think it shows a lot about the heart of these two teams. And these are both teams that could potentially contend for a national title. Or not just a national title, but a Big 12 regular season championship. Because I know when they meet again in Norman, it's going to be just as intense. It's going to be just as fiery. And I think it'll be the most anticipated game of the college basketball season, you know, moving forward when they play again later this winter.
Absolutely. There's no question. I mean, preseason basketball has hype throughout the season, but that showed that this early on, they have to be the 2 heavyweights.
Right.
Michigan State with Valentine would probably be a number 3, but I'd say Oklahoma, Kansas, 1 and 2 throughout the season, no matter what happens.
And I think they're the best basketball conference this year. I mean, obviously the ACC is always good, but Duke and North Carolina aren't the cream of the crop like they're used to. Kentucky is not as good as they have been in the past couple of years. They're still trying to put it all together. The Big Ten, sans Michigan State, not looking.
Iowa's up fire. There, which is just quietly there.
Yeah,
like in football.
I was having a great year just all around. If I was their athletic director, I'd be so thrilled with the way this year's gone for the 2 big sports this year. You know, one thing I didn't know. I'm sorry, I'm getting off topic, but we were at we got like a VIP tour of the athletics facilities, and one of the people that was in the career services for the Olympic sports at KU gave us a tour, and I asked, you know, what's the difference between, Olympic sports and then the non-Olympic sports? So what are the non-Olympic sports? And he said, well, it's mostly basketball and football, and women's basketball. And my dad, of course, not having a filter, he goes, you mean the ones that don't make any money? And she goes, you know, straight as a whistle, that's exactly right. These are the ones that Olympic sports, that's the way they categorize them at KU. Those are the ones that aren't bringing in the top dollar. But anyways, back to college basketball. Yeah, I think those are the 2. And I wouldn't be surprised if when the rankings come out next week, Oklahoma and KU don't move at all.
Oh, no.
I mean,
it's a solidified number one now.
Yeah.
But, I mean, number two has to be Oklahoma.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I can't wait to watch the rest of this college basketball season unfold. It's been really exciting thus far, but that's been the highlight, I think, of everyone's season so far in terms of people that really watch a lot of college basketball. How are the Mizzou Tigers doing this year, by the way?
I meant to ask. You know, they're actually doing better, not record-wise, but just they're an entertaining team to watch. Mm-hmm. Where last year, I mean, they just like looked like a fish out of water.
Yeah.
Just boring, were slow. And now I think the young guys, all the freshmen have bought in.
Mm-hmm.
And they're at least playing, like, I guess, Kim Anderson's ball now.
Yeah. I think that, you know, when you hire a new coach, that's one of the biggest things. It takes them a while to adjust to a style, to adjust to a way of playing. And I think you probably have seen that a lot with Mizzou. I mean, I knew the record wasn't good, but I know you've watched more games than I have. So I think, you know, there's certain things you look for when a team's rebuilding, you know, playing hard on defense, executing on offense, not making a lot of mental mistakes. You're going to place a lot of teams, especially in the SEC, that are just going to be better than you.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when you're able to put it all together and start playing to a style that, you know, suits your coach and suits your program and suits your conference, I think you'll start to see a turnaround. And I bet next year Mizzou's on the bubble as a tournament.
Well, yeah. I mean, we had when we went to the Kansas-Missouri game, or K-State-Missouri game at the Sprint Center, it was obvious Missouri is not there yet.
Right.
But in a few years, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. So shifting gears away from college basketball now and talking about one of the bigger stories in Kansas City this year, the Kansas City Chiefs. Back about, let's try and do the math here. 10 weeks ago, you and I were driving out to Arrowhead Stadium together to watch the Chiefs versus the Steelers matchup.
Yep. One and five.
And you and I had a very just disparaging conversation about the Chiefs that afternoon as we were riding in the parking lot. It was right after the American Royals, so the parking lot was still an absolute, you know, cluster. And we were, I think, our frustration levels had reached a peak. And the exact words that you used to describe this Kansas City Chiefs team this year was a dumpster fire. This has just been a dumpster fire of a season. We had just lost Jamaal Charles for the year. We were 1-5. We're calling Alex Smith the checkdown master. We thought Jeremy Maclin was a bust. There were a lot of things running through our head. Then, by the gift from the football gods, Landry Jones is pegged as the starter in that game because Ben Roethlisberger is out with injury. And the Chiefs managed to pull off a win against the Steelers. Sharkhandrick West had a really good game. Alex Smith didn't throw any interceptions, which he hadn't done since week three. And the Chiefs looked like, well, this might not be a total loss. We might finish the season 6-10, 7-9. Who knows what could happen? It won't be that bad. Well, we're 10 weeks later, and we've rattled off 10 straight wins. Did you think at that moment that this was ever in the realm of possibility? I mean, you can look at the schedule and see. You've got the Browns, Oakland twice, San Diego twice, Denver again, which will probably be a loss based on the way the season was going at that point. Did you ever think that this would be a possibility for this Chiefs team?
Oh, no. I mean, I thought 8-8 would be the best they could do and maybe finish out the season on a high note without a playoff appearance.
But beat the Raiders at home.
I actually thought they were probably going to lose at Denver. They're probably going to lose one of the Raiders games because they always seem to lose one of the Raiders
games. And at the time, I thought we would lose to Baltimore, too, because at the time, Baltimore wasn't as bad as they
didn't
the season.
They didn't become the
Dolphins. You know what? I think the tables really turned, and did Baltimore, you know, they lost Flacco, they lost Forsett, they lost
Steve Smith.
They lost basically all of their weapons.
Mm-hmm.
The tables kind of turned on them. I don't feel too bad about that. But so now, looking ahead to this weekend, the Chiefs play at 3:20 on Saturday. In Houston, 22 years ago, was the last time the Chiefs won a playoff game. You know what city that game was played in?
I believe it was the Houston Oilers at the time.
It was in Houston, and we had Joe Montana as our quarterback at the time.
Another San Francisco.
San Francisco reject is how I was called. And so I think not only is this a better Chiefs team all around, but fate is kind of on our side going into this game. I mean, this team is almost destined to win a playoff game this year.
You know, I want to agree with you on that, but just as a Kansas City Chiefs fan, whenever people want to buy in on the team, you always got to hold back just a little bit.
Right.
And just because of that, I mean, what, it's been two wins in our lifetime?
Yeah, two wins, but none that we really remember.
Oh, no, I was 1 year old.
Yeah.
And you were just turned two.
Just turned two. And then the other time. Yeah. I mean, it was, it's been a long stretch of failure, oftentimes to the Indianapolis Colts.
Yes.
This is the first time the Chiefs are back in the playoffs since 2013, second time under Andy Reid. We all remember what happened in 2013. We played another AFC South opponent. We were the wild card team. We played the AFC South division champions in the Indianapolis Colts, and we had a 24-point lead.
Something that was
going into the half.
Should have been insurmountable.
And the Chiefs lose.
Yes.
I mean, I was heading out to Keystone at the time, riding in the car. My friend Ross is sitting in the front seat with me. We're listening to the game. We got it on somebody's phone or something. And we were like, well, we're using data. Let's turn it off. This one's in the books.
On to next week.
On to the next week's opponent. Well, then the person in the back seat, phone notification. Oh, shoot. It's a 14-point game. Oh, shoot. Seven-point game. Oh, shit. It's tied, you know? So that was kind of the way it went. And then we watched the end of the game on a little tiny tube TV in our condo and basically threw things for about a half an hour as Andrew Luck and the Colts rallied to basically kick our asses in the second half.
He had a rushing touchdown, I remember.
Yeah.
On a fumble where he played basketball.
Fumble where it basically bounced back into his hands and then he scored. Well, this team is very similar when you look at the stats to 2013. I'm just going to go through some stats with you. In 2013, we were 11-5. In 2015, 11-5. In 2013, 430 points scored. In 2015, slightly less, 405 points scored, which is good for ninth in the league. Points allowed, 305 in 2013. In 2015, 287. So, again, lower. Good for third in the National Football League this year. So, very similar. And if you look at our opponent's record, we played a worse schedule in 2013. So, this Chiefs team is actually better than we were last year. And our strength of schedule is right in the middle of the pack for this year. We're 7-1 against losing teams this season, and 4-4 against teams with winning records. So 4-4, we're 500 against teams with winning records. One of those is the Houston Texans. That you can chalk that up for a win. People aren't forgetting, but we did beat this team in week one.
Yes.
This is kind of the conversation I want to have. You know, going back to the Chiefs' history of coaches, you can look at Hank Stram as obviously one of the greatest coaches the Chiefs ever had. He won the only Super Bowl in franchise history. Marty Schottenheimer kind of changed the way people view the Chiefs in this city after a couple of little rough stretch during the 70s and 80s. Herm Edwards, great motivator, not a great coach. Dick Vermeil won a Super Bowl, but not with the Chiefs.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of really – Gunther Cunningham, defensive mind, not really offensive. So we've got a lot of different kinds of coaches. But I will say Andy Reid is not the best coach in Chiefs history, but he by far has done the most with less than any coach ever has. This is not a in-your-face talented team when you break it down. I mean, our two starting running backs, I mean, I think we categorize them as two, are Spencer Ware and Charcandrick West, both of which were undrafted free agents.
Both were third and fourth on the roster behind Niles Davis.
Niles Davis at the end of the season. We have lost DeAnthony Thomas for essentially the last 6 weeks. Jeremy Maclin hasn't performed the level that we expected him to. We've got an offensive line that should be really, really bad, but somehow has managed to put it all together and be serviceable so that Alex Smith can drop back three steps and dink it off or throw a short, 12, 15-yard pass downfield. And then, of course, we have Alex Smith, who was the number one overall pick in 2004. But has managed to have a relatively successful career everywhere that he's gone, but somehow gets this reputation of, well, he's a game manager. He's a game manager. So we have a game manager at quarterback that's rattled off 10 straight wins and that is facing an AFC South opponent that we should beat on Sunday. And like I said before, I know I'm one of those people that gets really high up on chances before the eggs have hatched. You know, you don't want to count your chickens before your eggs have hatched, and I do it all the time. But there's no freaking way we lose on Sunday against the Texans. It is not possible. Unless J.J. Watt is cloned and there are 11 of him playing on both sides of the football on Sunday, there's no way this Chiefs team loses on Sunday.
There shouldn't be. The only way that the Chiefs would lose is if the Texans D stops them from scoring a touchdown and becomes, let's say,
a field goal kicker's duel.
Yeah, 10-14 victory by the Texans. I mean, that's the only way I see them winning. And that means our defense gave up some points.
Gave up two touchdowns to Brian freaking Hoyer. Okay, and he is the 30th best quarterback in the NFL, which means there are only two starting quarterbacks this year that were worse than Brian Hoyer. So I don't think that – I mean, again, I know I don't want to tempt fate. Football gods, please knock on wood. But there is no way that we lose this game on Sunday.
I mean, as you were talking about, like, all of the quiet offensive guys. I mean, we have the comeback player of the year in
Eric Berry.
We have probably the defensive rookie of the year in Marcus Peters.
One of the best secondaries in the game when Hussein Abdullah is healthy and you have Ron Parker and Sean Smith.
And you have linebackers of Derrick Johnson and
Tom Bahali
and Justin Houston.
Is back. And D. Ford has played very good football in Justin Houston and Tom Bahali's absence.
Yes.
So we have a lot of Mike DeVito, Jay Howard. You've got a lot of talent on the defensive side of the ball, and that's why we're top five defense this season. I mean, if you want to go down to defenses, the Houston Texans defense is really good. But they are also a very good scoring defense. They get a lot of points from their defense. I don't think they're going to get a lot of points from this offense or points from their defense off of the Kansas City
on
offense.
On our mistakes.
Because this team doesn't make mistakes.
Because we have a game manager.
We have a game manager at quarterback. And so I'm really, really excited to watch the game on Sunday or Saturday. Going to get a lot of good food, a lot of good beer, sit down and watch it and just enjoy what hopefully will be the first playoff victory in 22 years. Again, I'm 24, you're 23, so that's it. I don't even remember seeing Joe Montana play.
I don't know. My first like true Chiefs playoff experience was when I was 10 years old at the 03-04 no punt game.
The no punt game.
And since then, it's just been
Peyton the Chiefs punted once, and that was the difference in the game.
No, they missed a field goal.
Oh, that's right. We missed a field goal. I you know what? And I kind of hope that Peyton Manning. I hope that we get the Broncos in round two.
I do too.
Let's look forward to round two for a minute. Knock on wood. We're not counting any chickens before they hatch. But let's just say we beat the Houston on Saturday. And then the Bengals take care of business like they're supposed to against the Pittsburgh Steelers this weekend. Then we get Denver at Denver, which is where we beat them this year.
Well, we should have beat them at Arrowhead.
We should have beat them at Arrowhead. Beside the point,
we're going to be playing at Mile High.
We're going to be playing potentially a hobbled Peyton Manning, a Peyton Manning who can't throw an out anymore, who can't throw a ball downfield without overthrowing his receiver, and is maybe good for a couple good plays a game now at this point, because that's essentially what he gave him on Sunday. He gave the Broncos just enough to beat the Chargers on Sunday.
And as much as that is a knock against how he's aged, he still is Peyton Manning, and he still will have the 2-minute drive against us. And I just want to see the Chiefs be able to stop him after we beat the Texans.
The scariest thing for me would be that Peyton Manning gets hurt in the first quarter of the game against the Chiefs, knock on wood if we make it there, and Brock Osweiler comes in. Because if you're Gary Kubiak, you are crazy for not starting Brock Osweiler.
No.
He's able to roll out on play action. He's able to move a little bit in the pocket. He's able to make better throws downfield. Now, he does overthrow some receivers occasionally, but he will get better at that. But he is just a better quarterback at this point in his career than Peyton Manning is physically. Mentally, obviously Peyton Manning is one of the best in the game, but physically in terms of what he's capable of doing within that offense, which requires a mobile quarterback to move, get out outside the pocket, roll out, and make throws to guys downfield, Peyton can't do that. And I think that Brock Osweiler scares me more than Peyton Manning does at this top point in his career. And I never thought I'd be saying that a former third round backup quarterback, second stringer, would ever scare me more than Peyton Manning.
Brock Osweiler.
Brock, what did I say?
You said Peyton.
No, I didn't think that I would ever say that a
more than
a,
more
would scare
than
me more than Peyton Manning. Manning. But more Brock Osweiler does scare me more.
And
than
you know,
Peyton
I got to agree with you on that. I think Kubiak, he has to be thinking when there is the right time to pull Peyton, because Brock Osweiler showed against the Chiefs he can do that.
Yeah.
Like he can make plays. He made it a game, And I don't know whether it was the Chiefs just didn't have enough film, weren't ready for it, but Brock showed that he can play.
Yeah, he essentially won the division by coming back in that Patriots game, which basically everyone had written him off. They don't win that game. They don't win the division. Mm-hmm. They potentially, if the Jets win this week, didn't make the playoffs this year. And it's amazing how you can go in as the one seed on last Sunday and potentially not even be in the conversation of the playoffs.
Well, starting 7-0, and granted, you lose your Hall of Fame quarterback. But, yeah, you just don't have that opportunity without Brock Osweiler.
Yeah, without Brock Osweiler, I think Gary Kubiak's a little delusional because I think the idea that Peyton Manning, and of course he's obviously a Hall of Famer, obviously one of the best to play the game, but at this point in his career, he just doesn't have it. I mean, I was looking, when he had to do that press conference last mm-hmm. week about the whole HGH thing, which is a whole nother discussion for a whole nother day. They showed clips of his throwing drill, which we interrupted so he could come have to talk about. You know, he was all like, "You interrupted my throwing drill, so I had to come talk to you about it, defend my wife." And I understand the frustration there, but they showed the clips of his throwing drill. You see him coming back, doing the three-step, five-step drops, trying, making his reads. And then the ball comes out, and you're like, that's it? That's all you have on your throws? I mean, you see guys like Drew Brees, who's up there, Tom Brady, who's up there. They can still zip the ball. I mean, Peyton Manning, at this point in your career, you're putting a lot at stake. I mean, he had to have serious neck surgery. He might not be able to move next season if he tries to play again. And I think this is his last season. But, I mean, at what point do you say, look, you pull the Kobe Bryant, I'm not able to do the things that I'm able to do anymore. I'm going to walk off into the sunset.
I just don't know. I think Peyton might just have the, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to play my best, and I'm better than everyone on the field. I mean, mentally, he is all there, but mm-hmm. he's never had the arm strength, and it just shows even more now that he is 39.
Yeah, he's 39 years of age. There's certain guys that, because of the way they play, they can make it to, this point in their career and still be consistent. And, Peyton Manning could have been one of those guys, but his body has just deteriorated faster than, like, a Tom Brady or a Drew Brees. And, it's unfortunate. You never want to see one of the greats go out that way. But I think there's a possibility that he's the reason that the Broncos don't win in the AFC Championship or the AFC Semifinal, depending on who it is that they play.
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll have to wait and see. Again, this is all speculation, but, we just hope – well, we don't hope for the best for Peyton because we want to beat Peyton. But, we hope that he doesn't hurt himself or something like that. Terrible happens. So to end tonight's podcast, I wanted to talk about 2015 because 2015 was a pretty incredible year. You got a job. I got into law school. The Royals won the World Series. A lot of great things have happened. The Chiefs have gone on this magnificent, magnificent run. We're all back in Kansas City. It's been a really, really great year. And I think it goes without saying that the Royals winning the World Series in 2015 was by far the highlight. And we didn't really get a whole lot of opportunities to talk about it. But I just wanted to take this last, 10 minutes of the show, 5, 10 minutes, however long it takes, to just talk about not necessarily the specifics, stats and numbers and, this play and that play, but really about what this season – what this run of the last 2 years has meant to you as an individual, has meant, you feel like it's meant to this city, what you felt like it's meant just, growing up a Royals fan and having to go through so much sucky mediocrity, at times not even mediocrity, and what it's meant to you to have them reach the pinnacle this year.
I think that it really was the highlight of 2015.
Yeah.
I mean, the city coming together and almost 800,000 people showing up for the parade. It was incredible. Now, granted, I wasn't there at the parade, but watching it on TV, just seeing all the pictures and all of the stories that you guys mm-hmm. were able to tell me about, just going there and seeing the ticker tape parade.
Yeah.
Just seeing that the city come together was just inspiring.
Yeah. And one of the most impressive things and things that make me excited for the future of this city and of this organization and of the fans here is being down there. Obviously, I had other priorities that day besides like going with my family. I was there with all my, law school buddies. We got the day off, so we went to a bar and we're drinking and everything and eating and having a good time. But one of the things that struck me as I was walking around, a lot of families with a lot of young Royals fans, kids with their fathers with their kids on their shoulders, moms, helping their kids stand onto like light poles and carrying their kids around and getting to share in this. And it showed that there's a younger generation of Royals fans who are going to remember this moment, you know, as like our parents remembered 1985. Now, of course, our parents were older in 1985, but we only ever heard folk stories. I mean, that's essentially all it was lore and myth and legend of George Brett and Brett Saberhagen and all these guys. And, you know, of course, we had legends like Denny Matthews still with us that could talk about all these great things and paint a beautiful picture of what happened back in 1985. But we weren't there, and we didn't get to see it. It wasn't tangible. We never grew up with a World Series, which I think a lot of other organizations, big organizations like the Cardinals and the Giants and those and the Yankees that are accustomed to winning, don't really understand. We never had this generation of fans, young fans, that remember what it's like to win the World Series. So I think seeing all those young fans down there and knowing, like having faith for the future of this fan community and having faith in the future of this organization, that meant a lot. And it got me really excited for next year to go to the K and see all these fans again with their families, their kids, their loved ones, really sharing that. Because I think that was what it made people in Kansas City appreciate more so, was that the Royals are a family organization. They care about, you know, the fan experience and, you know, can bring in a consistent product. Every time you come out to the K, you know you're going to have a great time. And that atmosphere that they've kind of culminated was really out in full force the day of the parade, making it a family thing. Kids, I'm going to tell my kids, you're going to tell your kids about this run, and then hopefully they'll have World Series of their own to remember and a whole group of players to remember, because we got lucky. We hit the jackpot with this group. I mean, there's not a single selfish guy in that clubhouse. It was a totally team win or team first mentality for this team to win the World Series. And yeah, I just think it's meant so much to this city and to this town for it to happen, because we're a town that gets to be called a city. I mean, we're like a big town.
It's a big city with a small town feel.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's been an absolutely incredible ride. And I think it's made 2015, with already being a great year, you know, one of the best, we're going to remember it forever. Mm-hmm. So any final thoughts on the Royals before we go and looking forward to 2016?
I'm excited for this next year and seeing where the chips lie, how they respond to they did it.
Yeah.
Can they do it again? The pressure's now, can they win the division for 2 years in a row?
I was listening to The Drive today, you know, CDOT and Danny Parkins were talking, and Danny just said, look, this team now, the goal is to get back to the playoffs and then see what happens, because that's all you can ever hope for. You know, one swing of the bat, one bounce of the baseball, you know, can make the whole playoffs go a different direction. You know, we saw that in every game. Yeah, we saw that in the fourth game against the Astros. I mean, anything can happen. And I think it's only appropriate that we play Ellie Goulding's Anything Can Happen as we exit today.
I think that's
a great way to go into 2016. Anything can happen. All right, for Brody Johnson, this is Tom Randolph. We're excited to be back in the studio. This was fun.
This was good.
This was really fun to get back in.
Good to be able to get back
we'll
on
get
the
back,
thing.
We'll get back into
a little hiatus as we started our adulthood. And,
trying to get our our feet steady on the ground for adulthood. But we'll be bringing more shows back to the fans. The 15 to 20 or so that we have.
Hey, consistent fan base.
You know, we got 7 new followers on Twitter today.
Really?
Yeah, that's like the most we've ever gotten.
That's the
like,
highest spike.
That's more than like a month.
100% or 700% in one day.
Just jumped straight through the roof. So again, for Brody Johnson, this is Tom Randolph with BuiltOnTheBorder.com. Thanks for listening. Come back next week. We'll have more for you. Hopefully we'll be talking about a Chiefs win. In the meantime, it's icy, it's slick. Stay safe out there. Stay warm, Kansas City. Peace.